Good afternoon. It's my great pleasure to be able to introduce Ambassador Stephen Bosworth to you. Anyone interested in Asia, and particularly North Korea, knows his name and reputation, and we are most fortunate to have him with us this afternoon. He has been an ambassador to three countries: Tunisia from 79 to 81, the Philippines 84 to 87, and the Republic of Korea 1997 to 2000. Sir, he served in a variety of positions in the State Department, high-level positions, I might add, and after retiring, continued his diplomatic activities as the U.S. Special Representative for North Korea Policy for the Obama Administration from 2009 to 2011. Earlier, from 1995 to 1997, he served as Executive Director of the Korean Peninsula Energy Development Organization, known as KEDO. Ambassador Bosworth has been very active in the academic world, teaching at Columbia, Hamilton College. In his spare time, he managed to become the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, a post he held for 12 years, which has got to be a record for deans. Most recently, he is a senior fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, having retired as dean this past summer. He is a graduate of Dartmouth. He lives in Boston. He was chairman of the Board of Trustees at Dartmouth for some period. And we are delighted to have with him today Mrs. Bosworth. They were a day late getting down here because suddenly a granddaughter appeared on the scene, which caused them to cancel their flight for one day. It's my pleasure to welcome to the podium Ambassador Stephen Bosworth.
Well, Dan, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. This is, actually, I was telling some people earlier today, this is the second time that I've been in Naples to address this same group. I was here some 20 years ago, when I was just a mere boy. But I'm pleased to see that the organization is at least as durable as I am, and it's a great pleasure to be back. I think that organizations such as this play an increasingly important role in our country's effort to provide leadership on the international stage at a time when leadership is increasingly in short supply globally, and at a time in which the challenges for the United States and other countries in the international community have never been greater. I'm going to talk today a little bit about Northeast Asia as a region, and then I'm going to sort of shrink the focus a bit and talk about one of my least favorite countries in some ways, favorite countries in others, and that is North Korea, a topic of endless fascination for many of us. Northeast Asia is, I think, without question, one of the most, if not the most, strategically vital regions of the world today, from both an economic point of view and a security point of view. No other region is more important to the United States than Northeast Asia. This is a region which now contains two of the three largest economies in the world, China and Japan. It also contains the Republic of Korea, which in the space of one generation has become the eighth largest economy in the world. It contains countries with whom the United States has vital alliances in East Asia, namely Japan and the Republic of Korea. These alliances are the anchor points for the U.S. presence in East Asia and are vital to the stability of that entire region. It also, of course, is where we find China. a country with whom the United States has a very complicated relationship, a relationship which I believe is going to become more complicated still as we move forward in time. In fact, it is my personal view that the challenge of dealing with China from a foreign policy perspective is the most serious challenge the United States has ever faced in the field of foreign policy. Far more difficult, in my opinion, than the challenge of dealing with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Why is that? Primarily, it is true because our relationship with China is so complex. If you think about it briefly, our relationship with the Soviet Union was somewhat one-dimensional. It was clear they were a security threat to us. We had very little economic interaction back and forth with the Soviet Union, and we could deal with them in a security dimension. China is quite a different kettle of fish. China is a country with whom our economic relationships are growing ever more complicated and important for both us and the world community every day. It is a country with whom, which has become the largest trading partner for every country in East Asia, larger than the United States. It is a country which, of course, has enormous foreign exchange reserves held largely in dollars, and is, for that reason, the largest debtor that we have in the world. Of course, as the old saying goes about bankers, you know, if you owe them a few bucks, you're in their debt. If you owe them a lot of bucks, you're in each other's debt. And I think that's what has happened with China. The debt that we have with China is as much a constraint on China's freedom of action as it is on our freedom of action. In any case, only to underline that our relationship with China is going to be a very difficult challenge of management in foreign policy as we move forward in the decades to come. And then, practically at the center of all of this, lies this little country known as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, North Korea. And any of you who have spent any time thinking about North Korea, and I know I was speaking with someone here a little earlier who had actually visited North Korea back in 1995, it is a kind of bizarre place. There is nothing else quite like it any longer on the face of the earth. It is still very insulated from the outside world and very isolated. It is a country of enormous repression of its own citizenry, and it is a country which increasingly poses both to the region, namely South Korea and elsewhere in Northeast Asia, and to us, a significant security threat. I think to put North Korea in perspective, we have to go back a little bit in history. First of all, North Korea came into being at the end of World War II. When we and the Soviet Union each occupied approximately half of the Korean Peninsula in the aftermath of Japan's defeat in 1945. An American colonel and a Soviet colonel sat down in Korea and negotiated a line of demarcation between that part of the Korean Peninsula that would be occupied by the Soviet Union and that part of the north of the Korean Peninsula that would be occupied by the United States. Interestingly, from a historical point of view, the name of that American colonel was Dean Rusk, who later, of course, went on to be Secretary of State and who had to deal with the consequences of having drawn that line for 8 years as he was Secretary of State. In any case, there was sporadic fighting back and forth across that 38th parallel, which was where the line was drawn, for the first 5 years after the end of World War II. And in 1950, the North Koreans suddenly moved a major portion of its armed forces south and pushed all the way down to Busan at the tip of the Korean Peninsula. And looking around this room, I'm sure that many of you, like myself, remember the Korean War and lived through the Korean War. Some of you may have even fought in the Korean War. In any event, that war ended in a stalemate in 1953. It is not true that Vietnam was the first war the U.S. was in that we did not win. We did not win the Korean War either. And we were happy to have a stalemate, which was formalized through an armistice under the auspices of the United Nations. And that armistice, which was signed in August of 1953, remains in place today, so that technically, South Korea and North Korea, the U.S. and North Korea, remain in a state of war. And we have never resolved the armistice in favor of a peace treaty. And I'll come a little bit more to that later. But the fact that there was not a victory in 1953 is important to trying to understand where the Korean Peninsula is today and what motivates, at least in part, some of North Korea's behavior. Through the 1950s, 60s, and into the 1970s, there was intense competition between North Korea and South Korea. For the South Koreans, this was a period of great peril and a period in which they lived daily with the threat of renewed hostilities from the North. The United States and many of our forces had remained on the Korean Peninsula following the Korean War, but nonetheless, the threat of renewed hostility was there constantly. Moreover, North Korea, which benefited from the largesse of both Communist China and the Soviet Union, was doing quite well economically. And as recently as the mid-1970s, the per capita income in North Korea was higher than the per capita income in South Korea. Now, over the last few decades, that, of course, has been reversed in a major way. As I said a moment ago, South Korea is now the eighth largest economy in the world with a per capita income well in advance of $15,000 to $20,000 a year, depending upon how you count it. But it is a country whose population has very much joined the global middle class. They are middle class in terms of consumption and in terms of production. And as the eighth largest economy in the world, South Korea has become a very important participant in the global economy. In the meantime, particularly since the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, North Korea has languished, to say the least. And North Korea is now a country of abject poverty and indescribable difficulty for its population, a country in which in the late 1990s, they lost 5 to 10% of their population through famine, a country in which malnutrition is still a day-to-day part of their existence, in which the average North Korean is 5 inches shorter and 20 pounds lighter than his cousins living in South Korea, simply because of a difference in diet. And as the medical people among you will testify, that kind of malnutrition over time has a very pernicious effect on mental capacity. So that in effect, South Koreans as a group are now far more intelligent and far more intellectually capable than are North Koreans. Not to say that there aren't intellectually capable North Koreans. There are. But as an average in the population, North Korea is now a very deprived place. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, China's role vis-a-vis North Korea took on added significance, and China today continues to have a very important role vis-a-vis North Korea as a source of economic support. not as what I would define as a classic political ally, even though their relationship was forged in the blood that was shed during the Korean War. But China, for reasons of geostrategic interest, sees North Korea as a place in which they have a major strategic investment. And I'll come back to that a little later. Beginning in the 1980s, North Korea began to aspire to possess nuclear weapons. The outside world was not fully aware of that until the late 80s and the early 90s, when, as a result of some early assistance that they had received from the former Soviet Union and their own efforts, they put into operation a small nuclear reactor at a place called Yongbyon, in just north of Pyongyang. In the early 1990s, it became apparent that North Korea was embarking upon a nuclear weapons program. And the United States, first under the administration of George H.W. Bush and then under the administration of Bill Clinton, began a process of dialogue and negotiation with North Korea, with close cooperation from South Korea, to try to resolve this nuclear issue. In 1994, those negotiations resulted in something called the Agreed Framework of Geneva, an agreement we signed in Geneva with the North Koreans, and in which they agreed to freeze and eventually phase out their nuclear program in return for a number of things from the United States and the international community, including the construction of two 1,000-megawatt light water nuclear reactors and the provision of energy supplies in the short term, diplomatic relations with the outside world, etc. Now, it may seem counterintuitive to give North Korea light water nuclear reactors when we're trying to stop their nuclear weapons program, but this is a type of technology which is very resistant to proliferation. So it actually did make technical sense, as well as, at least at that time, political sense. And the Korean Energy Development Organization, which was referred to earlier by Dan, is an organization which I agreed, somewhat against my better judgment, to take on the responsibility of organizing and then running from 1995 to 1997. And we actually negotiated with North Korea on the terms and conditions under which we were going to build these nuclear reactors. And we began to negotiate and actually put in place the physical construction of the nuclear reactors. That, I frequently ask if those negotiations and that agreement was a success, because in 2001, in the first year of the Bush administration, the agreement began to fall apart. And by 2002, the agreement had disintegrated. We had stopped work on the light water reactors that we were building in North Korea. And North Korea had restarted the program that they had frozen in 1994 and had begun again producing plutonium, which is the kind of fissile material you get from a nuclear reactor and which enables them to begin or build more nuclear devices. So from 2002 on, they were again producing plutonium. So was the agreement, which eventually fell apart, worthwhile? In my personal judgment, it was very worthwhile, because while the agreement was in place, we had international inspectors present at the North Korean facility. We know there was no plutonium produced. Had they been producing plutonium from that plant, instead of the two or three devices that they probably had plutonium enough to build in 2002, they would have had enough plutonium to build at least a dozen nuclear devices. And from a proliferation point of view, that's a very important difference. In any case, beginning in 2002, they broke out of that agreement, and from 2002 to 2005, they were essentially running free. They were producing plutonium. We believe now they were also producing, beginning to produce enriched uranium, which is the other route to nuclear weapons, the other technical route to nuclear weapons, which also gives them fissile material. So in 2004, 2005, the U.S., working closely with China, South Korea, and Japan, began to put together something called the six-party process. And these were five countries plus North Korea, which had come together to try to persuade North Korea to again stop producing plutonium and work toward eventual denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And in September of 2005, the five plus North Korea produced something called the Joint Statement. And the Joint Statement had four major areas of agreement. One, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That's both North and South. Well, South Korea had already been a denuclearized zone, and the U.S. had not had nuclear weapons there for some years. The second major undertaking in that joint statement was to replace the armistice of 1953 with a comprehensive peace treaty to be negotiated between North and South Korea, the United States, and China. Thirdly, to establish diplomatic relations among all of the countries concerned. And fourthly, to provide significant amounts of energy and economic assistance to North Korea. That six-party process then continued on for the next couple of years and actually made significant progress. They began to dismantle the plutonium production facility at Yongbyon. We began to talk about an inspection regime, and we began to move toward implementation of the denuclearization part of the joint statement of 2005. In truth, there was less movement on the other three items, which were obviously of much more interest to North Korea than was denuclearization. So there began to be a certain imbalance between what North Korea perceived that it should be getting from the engagement in the six-party process and what it was really getting from the six-party process. So in 2009, when the Obama administration came into office, there was a general feeling that we had to give new dynamism, new momentum to the six-party process. And that was when I accepted the request of Secretary Clinton and the president to take on the task of being responsible for North Korea policy. Unfortunately, as I look back on this in retrospect, at that point in time, North Korea had no interest in that. They were intent on establishing that they were a power to be dealt with on the Korean Peninsula, and they were going through the beginning of another political transition in which Kim Jong-il, then the leader of North Korea, was visibly weakened physically and was beginning to prepare the way for the selection of and the coming into power of his successor, who turned out to be his third son, Kim Jong-un. Now, I know it's hard to keep all the Kims straight, but Kim Il-sung was the founder of North Korea back in the late 1940s and ruled until 1994 when Kim Jong-il, his son, came into power upon his death. And then in 2011, Kim Jong-un came into power when his father died. So Kim Jong-un is an interesting young man because he is, and I say young, deservedly, because he is young. He's probably 30 years old. We know very little about him. We didn't know all that much about his father either, although we did know more than we know about Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un was educated for a couple of years in a middle school in Switzerland, where the North Koreans presented him as the son of the embassy chauffeur. No one at the time knew exactly who he was, although Swiss intelligence suspected that he was not the son of the embassy chauffeur. So he came into power at the age of probably 28. He's probably 30 now, maybe a little more. And he is the titular face of this regime in North Korea. And as part of the process of preparing him to take power, it's clear that the regime wanted to demonstrate that it was dealing from what it considered to be a position of strength. So they conducted their second nuclear test in the spring of 2009. They conducted another long-range missile test, which they had first tried back in 1998. And they basically put a halt on all negotiations. We finally got conversations started with the North Koreans again in 2010 or late 2009. I actually went to Pyongyang and had what we thought were productive conversations with the North Koreans in Pyongyang in December of 2009. We were preparing to invite my North Korean counterpart to come to New York City for further talks in March of 2010, when suddenly a South Korean naval vessel was sunk and all hands were lost. And there was very good reason to believe, and I believe, that that was done by North Korea. It was not an accident. It was a very deliberate thing. There was later that year, there was a shelling of some islands that occurred. So it was not an easy time. And we did manage to have a series of talks, but those talks did not produce a durable agreement. So with the accession to power of Kim Jong-un, we now find ourselves back, in a sense, where we started. The North Koreans have underway a nuclear weapons program, we believe. They may have, well, two technical routes to producing fissile material, both plutonium and enriched uranium. And they have had another missile test, which in the final test last year or early this year was actually quite successful. They managed to put something into orbit. It did not re-enter as a ballistic missile would have had to do if it were going to deliver a warhead, but they're making progress, and it's worrisome. So we are confronting this dilemma that we have confronted for the last 20 years. What to do about this country, which defies international law, defies international opinion? The UN Security Council has voted repeatedly over the last several years to sanction North Korea because of its nuclear weapons program. And North Korea nonetheless continues. Why do they do this? Well, I think in their view, first of all, I'm frequently asked, are these people crazy? And my answer is no, they're not crazy. If you see the world the way North Koreans see the world, what they are doing is rational. Not perhaps logical, but you can construct a rational reason for their doing what they are doing. And that is that their view of how they came into being was that if the United States had not intervened in 1950, North Korea would have reunified the Korean Peninsula. And the Korean Peninsula would now be a peaceful, prosperous place under rule from Pyongyang. Instead, the United States came in, installed a puppet regime in Seoul, and that puppet regime continues to cause problems on the Korean Peninsula. So if the United States would pull out and leave them alone, the puppet regime would collapse, and finally the Korean Peninsula would be unified under North Korean domination. That, of course, is their creationist myth, and I stipulate myth, because that is not what really happened, and all of you are well aware of what really happened. But that is their justification for behaving in the way that they do, and it is also their belief that without the deterrent effect of a nuclear weapons program, that the United States, aided by the Republic of Korea, South Korea, would at any moment reach out and pummel them and again attack them. So for them, their nuclear program is an essential deterrent to aggression from the outside. So what do we do about all this? And this is, of course, the policy dilemma that we struggle with in Washington, and we've struggled with it for 20-odd years. We struggle with it in Tokyo and in Seoul and increasingly in Beijing. We have no good options. Our options are all bad. We could, in theory at least, we have what one might call a military option. We could try to bring about a change of regime in North Korea and either reunify the Korean Peninsula or bring about a situation in which a government in North Korea took power which was not determined to have nuclear weapons, which had different points of orientation. The problem with that is that that's not Pyongyang's view of the world. And if I could envision a way to bring about regime change in North Korea, I would opt for it in a moment. Because believe me, it is, in my judgment, one of the most reprehensible regimes that the world has ever seen. Their abuse of their own citizenry, their provocation of instability on the Korean Peninsula, and their general threat to stability throughout Northeast Asia are extreme. And there is no one that I know of who tries to justify the existence of North Korea as a good thing. It is a good thing only measured against the alternatives of trying to bring about a change of regime. If I could figure out a way to do that without putting at risk 44 million South Koreans, many of whom are within artillery range of North Korean artillery just north of the 38th parallel or the demilitarized zone, I would think that would be a reasonable thing to do. But believe me, there is no way to bring about through force the change of regime in North Korea that does not provoke an extreme threat to the security of South Korea and the existence of 44 million South Koreans. The other thing that we could do, of course, would be to simply do nothing and say that eventually North Korea will change and eventually maybe China will solve this problem for us. And the Chinese option periodically takes on more and more allure from the U.S. point of view. Now, the problem is that for China, this is an even more complicated problem than it is for us. China does not want North Korea to be a nuclear weapon state, and I am very convinced of that. The threat to China's longer-term interests from nuclear weapons in North Korea is quite profound. China, for example, is fearful that nuclear weapons in North Korea could eventually prompt South Korea and even Japan to move down the road toward acquiring their own nuclear weapons. And from China's point of view, that's a very undesirable outcome. From our point of view, it's a very undesirable outcome. But it is something that I think increasingly, if the North Koreans' nuclear weapons program begins to look like an acute threat, as it in some ways is, to security of Japan and the security of South Korea, the political processes in those countries is going to cause their leadership to look increasingly seriously at the possibility of developing their own nuclear weapons program. So China does not want to see that happen. On the other hand, China also views North Korea as a very useful buffer between itself and South Korea. A South Korea which, not coincidentally, or not incidentally, has a military relationship with the United States. And a Chinese nightmare would be to wake up some morning and find that the Korean Peninsula has been unified under South Korea, and South Korea's sitting just south of the Yalu River with a military relationship with the United States. That's a movie that many Chinese think they've already seen once. Many Americans think we've already seen it once, and we didn't like the way it turned out the last time. So the reunification of the Korean Peninsula, while it has many desirable features, also brings considerable risk, certainly from China's point of view and from the point of view of potential instability within the region. So I think for us to rely on our hope that China will somehow wake up someday and realize that its interest lies in doing what the U.S. would like them to do, and that is tell North Korea and mean it, that it cannot have nuclear weapons, is unlikely to come to pass. Now, the Chinese will continue to press the North Koreans to give up their nuclear weapons program, but I do not anticipate, and I hope I'm wrong, but I do not anticipate that China is going to come to the point at which it will seriously risk the collapse of North Korea, which they fear could be a result of their putting too much pressure on the regime in Pyongyang. A collapse of the North Korean regime in order to solve the nuclear problem. So that leaves us with what we've been trying to do, and I will concede without great success for at least 20 years, and that is to engage with North Korea, to negotiate with North Korea, and try to find a solution that will lead over time to the phasing out of their nuclear weapons program. And importantly, in my view, begin to deal with the kind of fundamental causes of instability on the Korean Peninsula. The nuclear problem is, after all, a manifestation of deeper problems on the Korean Peninsula, the largest of those being the existence of this terribly repressive regime in Pyongyang, a regime which has savaged its own population, which is a security threat to the United States indirectly, and certainly a direct security threat to South Korea and to Japan. And that, it seems to me, requires a broader approach to a negotiated solution. It is a problem not unlike what we're trying to solve now in the case of Iran, to address both the nuclear question, but also to address, over time, the problems of Iran's relationships with the United States and the rest of that part of the world. In the case of North Korea, I believe that South Korea must play a central role in bringing about an end to the nuclear problem, because only South Korea can address some of North Korea's most pressing concerns about their own future. And to the extent that North Korea needs massive economic aid, which it does, I would argue that they're unlikely under any circumstances to get that from the United States, nor indeed are they likely to get it from China. The one place from which they could get substantial economic aid would be from South Korea, and that's only going to happen if the two Koreas can find some basis of greater reconciliation, North and South, than exists now. There was an effort, and with some limited success, in that direction in the late 1990s when Kim Dae-jung was president of South Korea, when he put into place his so-called sunshine policy, which was really a code word for using South Korea's economic advantage to leverage North Korea away from dependence on its nuclear program and leverage them into some form of reconciliation, at least not perhaps total peace and harmony, but some form of affiliation with the South in a confederation or whatever the two Koreas would be able to agree upon. Now, it may be that that's beyond the capacity of South and North Korea to bring about, and I don't underestimate the difficulty involved. But I would also warn that, in my personal judgment, there is no other real solution to the problems of the Korean Peninsula. I don't foresee that under current circumstances, North Korea is likely to be willing to give up its nuclear program entirely. They may be willing to freeze it, to slow it down, whatever, but they're not going to abolish their nuclear weapons program. And we don't really know where they stand with regard to nuclear weapons, but they have had three nuclear tests, each more successful than the one that went before it. And given their past record, I think we should be prepared for the fact that they will eventually, if left free to pursue both nuclear weapons and long-range missiles, that they will put those two things together, and they will be a real security threat in Northeast Asia and conceivably, although I think this is very unlikely, across the Pacific. So I think where I personally come out, having been wounded several times by efforts to negotiate with the North Koreans, is that there is still no better alternative. There is no good alternative with regard to dealing with North Korea and the nuclear program. But my personal view is that in the end, we will come back to the question of negotiation, engagement, as we refer to it, and that we must create a situation in which South Korea increasingly takes over lead responsibility for dealing with the North. The time in which the U.S. could negotiate over the heads of the South Koreans with the North Koreans is past. We can no longer do that. So let me stop there. I hope that I've been at least informative, and perhaps I've even been sufficiently provocative to cause some questions.
All right, the microphones are set up back there, if you'll just step up. And then we'll just alternate back and forth. So we'll start over here to my right.
Ambassador, isn't there a dilemma for President Obama, who is seeking a nuclear-free world, and others who fear that North Korea's missile launches are merely a cover for the development of military ballistic missiles programs, that unlike in the nuclear field, where the NPT seeks to control nuclear weapon technologies within the framework of binding international laws, there seems to be no binding international law and a corresponding treaty with regards to ballistic missiles. And if you see that as a dilemma, what do you suggest could be a possible overcoming of this dilemma?
Well, I think you point to a very real problem. The NPT, of course, is set up to try to deal, when it's successful, with the problems of nuclear proliferation or the threat of nuclear proliferation. North Korea has, of course, withdrawn from the Non-Proliferation Treaty and is therefore, in their mind, free to do what they wish.
Thank you.
I think there is the prospect, and this is not easy, but there is the prospect of a missile technology regime which we would negotiate along with other countries with North Korea, which would rein in their missiles. And they have at times in the past announced freezes on missile tests. And in fact, from 98 until 2007, they did not test any long-range missiles. And we have had similar agreements in place with the Republic of Korea, because North Korea would argue, well, if South Korea can develop long-range missiles, why can't we? And North Korea's latest story, of course, is that they're developing not a long-range ballistic missile, but they're developing a space launch capability. Well, I don't personally accept that explanation. And I'm sure that they're trying to develop long-range missile capability. But you're right. It's the two developments, the two tracks, the nuclear track on the one hand and the long-range missile track on the other. And when those two cross, as I was indicating a few moments ago, that is when North Korea's threat becomes most extreme.
Over here, please.
First of all, I enjoyed your talk very much. It was very interesting. My question is about the divide within North Korea. When you see the limited coverage on the TV, it seems like we are looking at two different countries. One, you know, a small number of people who live in the capital city very well, and then the rest of the country which may be starving. So my question is, first of all, what is the divide between these two groups? And secondly, is there any possibility of almost something like a French Revolution where the masses rise against the limited number of people who are living very well off?
The short answer to your question is you are looking at two different worlds, not just two different countries. Having visited North Korea several times, the difference between life in Pyongyang for what we describe as North Korean elites and life in the countryside for the great majority of North Koreans is extreme. Countryside living is very, very difficult. The lives of the elites in North Korea is not what I would call a walk in the park, particularly when compared to the way the middle class lives in South Korea. The gap between lives of elites in the North and the middle class in the South is very, very great. How to change that? My own view is there has to be a change over time. It could happen abruptly, but a change over time in the nature and orientation of the North Korean regime. The elites of North Korea are invested in the regime because without it, their lives will not be very comfortable, to say the least. So I don't see any way that we can sort of peacefully bring about that kind of change other than through reconciliation between North and South and the building of some level of political accommodation between the two countries. But at the moment, the differences are extreme between North and South and between the lives of the elites and the mass of the population in North Korea.
Right over here, please.
Of the poor in the North Korea rising up?
No. I mean, I don't rule anything out. And I would stress that we know very little about life in North Korea on an individual basis. We can look at it. We can talk to defectors, which we do, which the South Koreans do. But the possibility of what some would describe as an Arab Spring in North Korea is not a possibility to which I give great credibility. The government, the regime is so repressive and the people are so beaten down that I just don't see that the conditions are such that that's likely to happen. I don't rule it out entirely, but I don't think it's something that we can count on to somehow be our salvation from this terrible situation that we find ourselves in.
Back here at this microphone, please.
Isn't China the clear winner under the status quo? I mean, for the United States to maintain this alliance with Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan, we borrow money from China, who turns around and recycles the dollars and buys natural resources throughout the world. So isn't China, wouldn't they prefer the status quo of just maintaining the way it is?
The Chinese. In some ways, yes, I think they would. They would prefer the status quo to the possibility or the probability of seeing North Korea collapse. The status quo they don't like, but it is not as threatening to their long-term interests and their view as would be a collapse of the North Korean regime.
All right, over here.
Yeah, we're seeing another hostage situation play out. Bill Clinton was successful in retrieving a hostage in the recent past, and short of a Dennis Rodman going over there, what's the way we're going to be able to get the present hostage back? And then I have another question.
I don't hold out great hope that Dennis Rodman is going to solve that problem. In fact, my wife and I were just in Europe several weeks ago, and I met with some North Koreans, and I asked them about Dennis Rodman. Because for most Americans, that's not the most natural intermediary between. And the North Korean that I was talking to kind of smiled ruefully and said, well, actually, we invited Michael Jordan, but he wouldn't come.
Okay.
So, but the hostage problem, I don't know what Kenneth Bay, who is the American citizen, Korean-American, who is being held for over a year there, is a sad case. But even sadder in some ways and harder to understand is the man who's now been taken off the airplane and is being held. I don't know what he said, but clearly his judgment was not great to go to North Korea. And whether he confessed to having done something or not having done something, I don't know. And I certainly think the North Koreans would be well advised to let him go. But this is not an amenable part of the world. I mean, someone was saying earlier they'd been there in 1995, had a great time. And you can do that. But you are in a country with which the United States does not have diplomatic relations, which has very capricious behavior, and which will take offense very easily at things that we would just shrug off. So I don't know what this gentleman said. I fervently hope that he's released soon, and I would think that probably the North Koreans will let him go eventually. But I think everyone should be very careful about going to North Korea and what they say when they go there.
The other question I had was with regard to your analogy between North Korea and Iran. The idea of sanctions, does that play any role whatsoever with regard to what the pressures might be brought to bear on North Korea as they have been on Tehran? And they have starvation problems there. They run out of food. Aren't there leverage points that can be applied?
Well, they have food problems, but not because of necessarily the sanctions. They have food problems because their economy is in a state of virtual collapse, and they don't really have the knowledge, wherewithal, or imagination to fix it. But the differences also between Iran and North Korea are important. Iran has a middle class of some substance, and the sanctions in Iran have really hit the middle class particularly hard. North Korea is already most heavily sanctioned country on the earth. They've had sanctions since the Korean War, sanctions because of their nuclear programs, sanctions because of terrorism, everything you can think of. And they have almost no freedom of interaction with the outside world. So they've learned to live with sanctions, unfortunately. They would like to see them go away, but so far they've been unwilling to do the things that would bring that about. But while there are similarities between Iran and North Korea, and what I was advocating is for the U.S. and its allies to take the kind of comprehensive approach to North Korea that we're trying to take with regard to Iran, I also see great differences between the two.
All right, over here, please.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you. Could you give us your evaluation or our country's thinking about the power of the military in North Korea and the power of Kim Jong-un with regard to that the military, the control of the military?
Yes. I'm not sure anyone can fully describe the role of Kim Jong-un within the North Korean regime, who is not sort of a member of the North Korean elites. Because for all of us, myself included, looking at it from the outside, you wonder how this 30-year-old whippersnapper, so to speak, could possibly be making decisions that affect the livelihoods and existence of senior military generals, senior party officials, etc. And the answer, I think, is that he's probably not making decisions unilaterally. He is part of a collective decision-making process. But they need him because, as I was indicating, he is the face of legitimacy in a regime which has no other basis of legitimacy other than the family and being the founding family of the North Korean regime. So they need a Kim at the center as the face, and that's what he gives them. But is he in a position to question the judgment of senior generals collectively? No. Individually, we know that he has removed, or there have been removed, individual North Korean generals over the last year or two who probably did not go willingly and voluntarily. So how did that come about? It must have come about through collective decision on the part of this relatively small group of people at the very center of North Korea.
Hi, is Russia involved or in the picture at all?
Pardon? I'm
Russia.
Sorry?
Is Russia involved in any
way? Not nearly as much as they would like to be, and not nearly as much as China is. Russia still is a member of the six-party talks, although there have not been any six-party talks since 2008. But Russia contends that it has a geostrategic interest in the region. They are an Asian power in a sense because of their landmass. And they have a long-standing relationship with North Korea. And they have a very small, short common border. But they are not what I would call a major player in all of this. The major players are really South Korea, the United States, and China, with Japan having a role, but somewhat less than the others, and Russia's role being less still. So thank you all very, very much. I've enjoyed being with you.